and maybe laughing about it.
This is 30 Years of Nonsense.
Hosted by Terry and Sherry Doherty.
Only on CFRC 101.9 FM, Kingston's campus and community radio.
Turn it up
and embrace the nonsense.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello, it is now 5 o'clock here at CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and you are listening to The Corridor, bringing you local and regional news from Kingston and the surrounding area, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering the first ever Cassie and Friends Kingston Run for Juvenile Arthritis Awareness.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. For most toddlers, learning to walk is one of the first big milestones. But for Cassie Port, that milestone suddenly disappeared. At just 20 months old, she woke up one morning unable to walk, a moment that would lead to a diagnosis that would shape the rest of her life. Cassie was diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis, a chronic autoimmune disease that causes joint inflammation, pain, fatigue, and without proper treatment, long-term damage in children. But what began as a frightening diagnosis eventually grew into something much bigger. The Cassie and Friends Run, a national charity helping families across Canada. I sat down with Cassie, now a third-year health sciences student at Queen's University, to talk about how it all began.
So my name's Cassie, and when I was 20 months old, I woke up and I just wouldn't walk. So I had been walking like the night before, and I just wouldn't walk that morning. And my knee was the size of a baseball. So my parents quickly rushed me to the hospital, where eventually I was diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis. So that's a bit different than like rheumatoid arthritis, which is found in older people. So I was diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis, or JIA. And my parents were searching and searching for support where they could meet other families with children with arthritis and stuff like that. But all they could find was arthritis support for older people. So my dad decided to sign up for the Scotiabank 5K run and raise a bit of money for research and stuff like that. And he sent it to some of his colleagues and his friends, and practically overnight raised close to $18,000, which was very exciting. And we went to the run. We cheered on my dad. He ran the 5K. And that day, under the rainy tent, pretty much Cassie and Friends and the idea of it was born. And my parents wanted to be able to support other families like me and that had children like me or siblings like me, so other parents could meet each other, so other children could meet each other, and to raise money for research for juvenile arthritis.
Nearly two decades later, Cassie and Friends is Canada's only national charity dedicated to children and youth living with juvenile arthritis and other childhood onset rheumatic diseases. Cassie grew up attending events organized through the charity, meeting other kids facing the same challenges she did.
Cassie and Friends has always been a great support system for me. We've had events like other runs every single year. I'm from Vancouver, so I would go to the ones in Vancouver. We also had something called Family Day, which is a whole day with activities for the kids and conferences for the parents. So parents will listen to speakers that give them different tips or new research to support their children with arthritis, while the kids would do fun activities for different age groups and get to meet each other and make lots of friends and, you know, like when I would go to school, no one would have arthritis or do injections once a week like me. So when I could meet other kids that were going through the same thing, it was very nice to have that support. And I've definitely been able to maintain a lot of those friendships.
That experience also helped shape Cassie's career ambitions and ultimately led her to Queens.
Because I was so in the medical, like, I guess, in the medical world and like immersed in it from such a young age and going to all these doctor's appointments, that led me to become very interested in science. And just like anyone else, I was interested in science. I applied to Queens Health Sciences and got in, which was very exciting. And I always knew I wanted to do something in medicine because I was so immersed in that world growing up. And as I started learning a bit more and studying, I became interested in pediatric rheumatology, which is the exact kind of doctor that I went to. And I just feel like I would have such a unique perspective for these other kids like me. And pretty much, I just want to be able to help other kids like me. And that's what's led me down the path of medicine and specifically to pediatric rheumatology.
Now studying at Queens, Cassie is helping bring that support network to Kingston. On March 7th, Kingston will host the first ever Team Cassie and Friends run at City Park. The event is organized with the support of the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club, which brings together students living with arthritis and other rheumatic conditions.
I have to give credit, actually, to one of the old presidents of the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club. She started the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club when she got diagnosed. And the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club brings together Queens students with arthritis and other rheumatic diseases. We make care packages to send to other students with rheumatic diseases that have ice packs and heating pads and injection support and stuff like that, as well as having different events to bring people together. So similar to what Cassie and Friends does to meet other students with the same disease. And we decided to collaborate with Cassie and Friends and host one of these runs because a lot of different communities, like in Hamilton, they do them. In London, there's a lot of different community runs. And we thought, well, we have this club here, so why don't we have a run in Kingston? And that's how it came to be.
In addition to raising funds, the run is also about building community, something that can be difficult in smaller cities like Kingston.
I think that this really raises awareness that there can be rheumatic diseases in students. And the transition to any university is tough, like learning how to live alone and having so much more independence, cook your own meals, all that stuff. You have to adjust to that no matter what. And then when you have a rheumatic disease, there's added things to adjust to. Like, I had to learn how to do my injections on my own before my mom had been doing them. Or it's so much colder here than back in Vancouver, and that definitely affects my joints as well. So there's just so many other aspects that you have to think about. And this run and Queens Rheumatic Disease Club in itself can bring all these Queens students together that have rheumatic diseases. And then for the Kingston community, since Kingston, there's no children's hospital here, and I'm pretty sure the closest ones would be like SickKids or in Ottawa. So a lot of these families that have children with rheumatic diseases, they have to travel really far to get their specific treatment. By hosting this run in Kingston, these families are able to meet other families in their community. And it's the same thing that Family Day does or these runs do in other places, is it allows them to meet other families in the Kingston community, especially when there's so few compared to those bigger cities.
Raising awareness is another major goal. According to recent polling, only about 1 in 5 Canadians know that arthritis can affect children. And yet, early diagnosis is critical, as delays can lead to joint damage, chronic pain, and long-term damage. Funds raised through Cassie and Friends support research, family support programs, and improve treatments.
So right now, the main focus of Cassie and Friends is looking for a cure. So a lot of research focus on a cure for juvenile arthritis. But there's also the treatment aspect. So a lot of treatment can be provided to adults, but it's much harder for that to get tested and approved in kids. So there's a lot fewer options. So a lot of the money from Cassie and Friends goes to research, raising money for research for this treatment for children. Like, for example, in myself, I was on a medication all through my childhood where I got an injection once a week and it made me so nauseous, the side effects. Like, it handled my arthritis perfectly fine, but it just made me so nauseous. And when I switched to an adult rheumatologist in Kingston, I was telling her about this and I was like, is there anything we can do about the nausea? And I've been asking this forever. And my pediatric rheumatologists were always like, oh, you can try eating a sour candy. You can try watching a show, like things to distract yourself. But when I spoke to my adult rheumatologist, she said, well, why don't you try this pill? She was like, have you ever tried it before? And I was like, no, I've never been offered that. And she was like, oh, well, it's not approved in kids. It's only approved in adults. And this has changed my life completely because now I only do one injection a week because this one has switched to a pill and I get significantly less nauseous. So that's a perfect example of how there's so much more options, so many more options for adults, whereas in children, there's so many less. And this fundraising can provide funds for research for this treatment in children.
Ultimately, Cassie hopes the Kingston Run helps students and families connect.
So firstly, I hope that there's awareness raised around juvenile arthritis and other childhood rheumatic diseases in general, whether that's in the Queens community or the general Kingston community. And as well, I hope that people make friendships and bonds with each other. I hope that parents can meet each other and talk about what they went through, even if it's my dad's coming from Vancouver. So even if it's someone talking to my dad, even if it's not in the same city, just so they have people to talk to that have gone through a similar thing, the children as well, the siblings. I hope that everybody can form bonds and connections that can help them with their disease and diagnosis further on.
Cassie also noted that bringing the first Cassie and Friends Run to Kingston has been a true team effort, with support from both the national organization and students right here at Queens.
Yeah, I want to give a big shout out to all of the Queens Rheumatic Disease Club exec. They've been great in finding sponsorships, planning the run, getting the cupcakes, everything like that. I've had a lot of help from them. I've had a lot of help from Marissa and Natalie at Cassie and Friends. And everyone has been very supportive and very helpful in planning this run. And I'm so excited to see how it turns out.
Once again, the first Team Cassie and Friends Kingston Run takes place March 7th from 9 to 11 a.m. at City Park. Registration and donations are available through the Cassie and Friends website. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this is Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Now over to CFRC's Henry Walker with a story by Michelle Dory Forstell, LJI reporter for The Kingstonist, about judicial decision-making related to the Napanee bylaw case over a Bridge Street property.
Thank you, Dinah. A Superior Court judge has reserved her decision after hearing arguments in the town of Greater Napanee's application to enforce municipal bylaws against a rural Bridge Street property that the town says is being used as an unpermitted residential trailer compound. Justin Robin Ryan Bell of the Ontario Superior Court of Justice heard submissions on Wednesday, March 4th, 2026, in the case Corporation of the Town of Greater Napanee, et al. Versus Bellinger, et al., an application brought under Section 440 of Ontario's Municipal Act. The town is seeking a court order or requiring the owner of the property, Jack Bellinger, to remove multiple trailers and other structures and bring the property into compliance with zoning and property standards bylaws. Due to the municipal involvement, the court's procedures, including last Wednesday's hearing, are taking place at the Frontenac County Courthouse, located at 5 Court Street in Kingston, rather than in neighboring Napanee. Bellinger and another respondent, Michael Godfrey, represented themselves during the hearing and did not file sworn affidavit evidence in response to the municipality's application. This, despite being given an extended period of time to do so at a hearing in January, with instructions given by Ryan Bell at that time. At the conclusion of the hearing, Justice Ryan Bell said, "I will be reserving my decision on this matter. I hope to have it out to the parties within the next couple of weeks." James McCarthy, counsel for the municipality, told the court that the property at 1388 Bridge Street is zoned prime agricultural, which allows only specific types of residential use. Those permitted uses include a single detached dwelling home, certain converted dwellings, group homes, special care facilities, transitional housing units, or home occupation slash industries. McCarthy argued that the current use of the property, which T described as multiple recreational trailers and makeshift structures occupied by residents, does not fall into any of those permitted categories. Zoning bylaws are admittedly a little weird, McCarthy told the court, because unlike most bylaws, under a zoning bylaw, every use of the land is illegal, except if an exception is made for a specific property. The town zoning bylaw, he explained, defines a dwelling house as a building used as a residence, but explicitly excludes trailers, motorhomes, or similar structures. So a trailer is clearly excluded from the definition of a dwelling house in the bylaw. A trailer does not count, he said. Because of that definition, McCarthy argued the trailers currently on the property cannot qualify as permitted residential uses under the zoning bylaw. The municipality is therefore seeking a statutory injunction under Section 440 of the Municipal Act to enforce compliance. The municipality is requesting the court's assistance in enforcing its bylaws, McCarthy said. The town's case relies primarily on an affidavit evidence filed by Deputy Fire Chief James Feeney, who attended the property in July 2025, in connection with a separate fire safety matter. According to McCarthy, Feeney observed between eight and ten trailers on the property, along with a crescent hut, that is a lightweight prefabricated structure of corrugated galvanized steel that is semi-cylindrical in shape, sheds, propane tanks, and other materials. Drone photographs taken in May 2025 and included in the application record show trailers scattered across the rural property and connected by makeshift dirt roads. What we see in the photographs, McCarthy told the court, is effectively a compound, a makeshift neighborhood that has popped up here outside the supervision and regulation of the planning process. McCarthy said that the municipality has concerns about safety and sanitation at the site, pointing to photographs in the record showing garbage piled between trailers and muddy, rutted access roads. There are a number of photos where we can see that garbage is simply disposed behind the RV, close to the neighbors, he said. The town has also raised concerns about a lack of typical municipal services. We don't have information, unfortunately, on what's done with human waste and wastewater, McCarthy told the court. The municipality's position, he said, is that the zoning and building regulations exist as part of a broader system intended to ensure safe living conditions. This isn't simply the town being difficult and saying, follow the rules, McCarthy said. These rules fit into a puzzle that helps ensure adequate standards. The town is asking the court to declare the current use of the property unlawful under municipal bylaws and order the removal of trailers and other materials from the site. McCarthy said the municipality would allow time for compliance and suggested a deadline of May 1, 2026 for the property to be brought into conformity. We appreciate that it's going to take some time to do this, he said. The respondents, Bellinger and Godfrey, represented themselves during the hearing. Justice Ryan Bell repeatedly reminded the respondents that the court could only consider evidence properly filed in the application record. Because no responding affidavits had been submitted, the respondents were limited to responding to the municipality's submissions rather than introducing their new evidence. Bellinger told the court he had tried to help people who might otherwise have no other dwelling options. These people have nowhere to go, he said during the hearing, adding that forcing residents to leave the property could result in vulnerable individuals being pushed back onto the streets. Bellinger also indicated he was willing to work with the municipality to address its concerns. I will work with the town, he said. I will try and put it in order. He told the court he had never previously been involved in legal proceedings and was unfamiliar with the requirements of an application hearing. I've never done this before, he said. I don't know what you're saying, that I have to submit everything. During the hearing, Godfrey attempted to bring a motion asking the court to strike Feeney's affidavit from the record. Godfrey argued he had not been given the opportunity to cross-examine the deputy fire chief, saying, I didn't receive an invitation to see his testimony. Justice Ryan Bell rejected the motion. She noted that a timetable set earlier in the proceedings had provided an opportunity to conduct cross-examinations on Tuesday, February 17, 2026, and that he had been the respondent's responsibility to request such an examination. Godfrey said he did not believe he needed to give advance notice, but the judge told him a second time, in fact, you do need to. She ruled the motion was improper and confirmed that Feeney's affidavit would remain part of the record. The property at 1388 Bridge Street has been under scrutiny by the town of Greater Napanee for at least 2 years due to safety and bylaw concerns. In July 2025, town officials attended the property with assistance from the Ontario Provincial Police, public works staff, and the fire department, serving court documents and seizing several wood-burning stoves that were considered unsafe. Municipal officials have said the property contains makeshift dwellings and structures that pose fire hazards and other risks. The town says it has begun trying to achieve voluntary compliance in 2024 through education and negotiation with the property owner, but was unsuccessful. As a result, the municipality applied to the Superior Court for an order compelling compliance with zoning and property standards bylaws. Court documents identify the applicants as the corporation of the town of Greater Napanee and the town's chief building official. Bellinger is listed as the primary respondent, along with unidentified occupants described in the application as John Doe and Jane Doe. The application first came before the court on January 22, 2026, when Justice Ryan Bell adjourned the matter after determining that the self-represented respondents had not filed admissible evidence. At that hearing, the judge explained that the proceeding was not a trial, but rather that it was an application, meaning evidence must be presented through sworn affidavits rather than oral testimony. She granted additional time for affidavit material to be filed and set a timetable for cross-examinations and written submissions before the matter returned to court in March. Despite that timetable, no responding affidavit evidence was filed before Wednesday's hearing. The judge's ruling, expected in the next couple of weeks, will determine whether the court grants the town's request for an injunction requiring the property to be brought into compliance with municipal bylaws. If the order is granted, the court could require the removal of trailers and other structures from the site and prohibit further residential occupation in recreational vehicles or similar structures unless they comply with zoning and building.
Thank you, Henry, and to Michelle Dory Forstell of the Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Brenda Little, LJI reporter for CJPE County FM in Picton, about the town's participation in the Coldest Night of the Year movement.
Hi, I'm Craig Foster, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJPE 99.3 County FM in beautiful Prince Edward County. Coming are some of the top stories from PEC. You can hear County FM news 5 days a week, six times a day on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county, or stream us at 99.3countyfm.ca.
There was an exciting buzz in the main hall of the Picton Community Center on Saturday as nearly 200 people came together to participate in the Coldest Night of the Year fundraising walk. It is the first time Prince Edward County residents have participated in the nationwide annual fundraiser that supports local charities helping people who are experiencing hurt, hunger, and homelessness. The early evening was cold but sunny for the walkers to stroll the 2 or 5 kilometer route around historic Picton. And the hope was to raise $30,000 for the Picton United Church Food Bank, but thanks to the generosity of the community, they expect to raise over $65,000. Mark Houghton is a volunteer at the food bank and spearheaded the idea to take part in the Coldest Night of the Year fundraising event. Mark tells us more.
Yeah, we're the first-time crew, and of the first-time walking groups, we are number one across Canada. We raised $63,000 for the Picton United Church Food Bank. We had 135-plus walkers. We had 35 volunteers, and they had over 640 donors amongst them. Wonderful. Unfortunately, we're 40% up year over year in terms of volume for our food bank. They're all new clients. They're folks that that need a little bit of help.
And are they all from Picton or from the area?
We serve Picton, basically half the county. The other half serviced by Wellington.
Tara Wood rounded up a team of her friends called the County Huggers, and they were the top fundraisers, bringing in $14,000. Tara tells me more.
And Tara, you have a huge group that made a whole bunch of money. What do you call yourselves?
We're the County Huggers.
And how did you make all this money?
You know, we are a group that moved here about 5 years ago. We all kind of moved from different places, and we love our community. Personally, myself, I got interested in the food insecurity mandate out here, I had no idea the stats of how many people in our community were going without food, so I got involved with the Wellington Food Bank and the PEC Food Collective. It's an issue that's become very close to my heart. I got a bunch of my friends involved, and it's been super fun having a competition to just raise funds and do really good.
So your group, are you entrepreneurs or what?
I think most of us are entrepreneurs. Most of us are small business owners out here, but I think, you know, we just share a passion for community, right?
Yes.
We just love the people where we live.
Yes. It's amazing that people from away come here and grasp on to the needs.
Yep.
So quickly.
100%. And I mean, we are lucky that I have never struggled. We know that we have privilege, and we want to make sure we are doing good for others, because it's so important that we give back and everyone continue to play a role and raise awareness, whether that's donating, giving their time, giving money, getting involved. You know, volunteering doesn't need to be a weekly commitment. It can just be as you need it. There's so many ways to get involved, and so many great organizations that you can give your time to.
I understand you guys have raised $13,000, if I'm not
mistaken. We're like $60 short of $14,000, so
Oh, wow.
We will get there.
I caught up with a few walkers to see how they enjoyed their evening stroll, and they seemed invigorated. How was the walk, folks?
The walk was invigorating.
Oh, good.
It was great. The wind was keeping us energized. The roads were dry. And, yeah, feel great.
And we got these great hats.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And it's a good cause.
It yes. is. It's a great cause.
And
yeah.
Meeting community members, seeing everybody out together is very inspiring.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
And thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Coming up, CFRC's Juliana Gonsalves is reading a story by Michelle Dory Forestell of the Kingstonist on March break activities at the Museum of Lennox in Addington.
Thank you, Dinah. For parents wondering how to entertain their school-age children during March break, the Museum of Lennox in Addington has the answer. This year, the museum is hosting several events as part of its March Break Create programming. Kids and families are invited to dive into hands-on experiences that spark creativity through art, music, storytelling, movement, and more. From historical discoveries through animated storytelling to experiences that will make children build big and think creatively, the museum's March Break programming promises to thrill and delight. The scheduled programming includes Create Stories, the Big History Mystery, with the Paddling Puppeteers on March 16th at 11 a.m., the Create Music, Sing and Dance with Kingston Frontenac Music Together on March 17th at 11 a.m., the Create Art Nature Art Workshop on March 18th at 11 a.m., Yoga Poses with Pups on March 19th at 2 p.m., the Create Connections Make Your Own Clay Magnet events on March 20th at 10:30 a.m. and again at 2:30 p.m. And finally, the Create Structures Build Quest drop-in event starting at 10:30 on March 21st. Aside from the event on March 20th, all events are $5 with free admission for those under 5. For more information, please visit countrymuseum.ca.
Thank you so much, Juliana. Coming up next, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region. Tuesday night, we're expecting cloudy skies with a 60% chance of showers and a low plus 3. On Wednesday, showers with a high plus 6. Wednesday night, periods of snow or rain, low minus 2. On Thursday, cloudy with a 40% chance of flurries, windy and a high of 0. Thursday night, cloudy skies with a low minus 6. And on Friday, we'll see periods of snow, high plus 1, and cloudy with a 40% chance of snow on Friday night with a low minus 8. And now back to Juliana Gonsalves with this week's concert and events calendar.
Hello, hello, and happy Leprechaun Week. It's your girl Gigi, CFRC's newest intern, and you're listening to What's Live at 5 on CFRC 101.9 FM. Coming up on this segment, I've got Cape Town's hottest concert and event calendars for the week. Tuesday, March 10th marks my favorite, Tom's Tuesday Afternoon Happy Hour Jam with Tom Savage at the club at the RCHA at 4 p.m. until 7 o'clock p.m. The dance school will also be performing their production of George Orwell's Animal Farm at Theological Hall Rotunda Theater at 7:30 p.m. to 10 o'clock p.m. Be sure to come out and support. On Wednesday, March 11th, Why Not Theater presents What You Won't Do for Love, a hybrid live theater and film performance starring renowned environmentalists Drs. David Suzuki and Tara Cullis, reflecting on their 50-year relationship, their shared adventures, and their advocacy for the planet. This charming and conversational show asks, can we learn to love the planet as much as we love other people? Find them at the Kingston Grand Theater Rosen Auditorium at 7:30 p.m. The Wonderful Women Community Choir will be meeting at Crossroads United Church at 1 p.m. until 3 o'clock p.m. Don't forget to bring your wonderful voices.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us.
Folk Everything is your passport to the finest in folk music. Old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, he won't bother you. He's a busy man, he's got things to do.
It's all here Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Folk Everything with Hugh on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
So hello and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today we have a special guest, Dr. Ian Matheson, who is the new Associate Dean in the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs. Welcome to Grad Chat, Dr. Matheson.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And generally, I like to ask our graduate student and postdoc guests about how they ended up at Queen's in their current position. So would you mind telling us a little bit about how you came to your current role as Associate Dean?
Yeah, absolutely. We were chatting on the way here about how we did grad school together at the Faculty of Education way back. And I spent a year at the University of Regina just after I finished my PhD or was finishing it up, came here. And I did the last 6 years in the Faculty of Education as an assistant and then associate professor in special education. And Chris DeLuca is my predecessor in the role. And I think he just kind of recommended me as he was phasing out. He thought I would be a good fit for the role. And I hope it's been okay so far. I'm enjoying myself.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, it's great. It's, well, we miss Chris. It's nice to have you in the new role. So I was curious a little bit to learn about what that transition was like from PhD student to assistant professor and then now into a more administrative faculty role. Could you tell us a little bit about what it was like to make that jump?
Yeah, that's a good question. I am still trying to make sense of it because it feels like it's all happened so quickly. Moving from being a PhD student to my first academic appointment, as I said, I was at the University of Regina, was odd because when I started the role in Regina, I was still a PhD student. I hadn't defended, and I actually didn't defend until around this time of year. I think it was Valentine's Day or maybe a month after that that I defended ultimately. And during that year, you're starting as a new assistant professor with essentially handling your research program, doing service, and then a teaching load, which was a lot. But at the same time, I was still finishing up my PhD.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
I'm doing revisions and getting ready for defense. And at the same time, oddly, the job came up at Queen's and I wanted to come back. My wife's family is from here. My family now lives here. So this is where we wanted to be. So on top of all that, I'm secretly applying for this job, eventually getting mid-listed and then shortlisted. So I just remember going for runs or walks with my German Shepherd, and I was like talking to myself about the interview, you know, what I would say to this or my job talk or whatever. And it felt like, and we were expecting a new baby, our first.
Oh my goodness.
So it was a lot for sure. But I just kept my head down, and I didn't have a lot of time to think about the transition. But I did think a lot about the transition from that to Queens. Mm. And that felt like my first real one, because at that point, my PhD was behind me and I felt more ready to step into. Now I can really join the ranks and feel what it's like to be a professor and not still have to worry about getting my PhD done. And that I would compare to, for those that are drivers or for those that aren't, in Ontario, we get a G1 license where you need to drive with somebody else who has their license. And then eventually you get your what's called your G2, and you don't have to have anybody in the car with you. And that's what it felt like for me, is that when I got my PhD and I was a professor at Queen's, I didn't have to have anybody in the car with me. In fact, I got to choose who was going to be in there with me. So it felt a little more free, because I didn't really feel bound to say, I wonder what my supervisor is going to think of this idea. Now, I loved my supervisor and he was always supportive, but just not having that layer, I think I felt a little bit more open and free to say, where do I want to take my program of research? So that was really cool. But at the same time, I was starting at a place where all of the professors that I had were now my colleagues, and that was super weird. They were kind and supportive, but I think for me, psychologically, KM, I didn't really realize, like, it took me a couple of years to get over that hurdle, and I don't know what it's going to be like for students that might hear this or for students that have gone through the same transition, but I think it took me a while to get to a place where I was, like, reminding myself that I'm not a student anymore, and I'm really in charge of a different kind of portfolio now. Supervising was always like the coolest thing to me, because I've always loved collaborating and working with other people. And the fact that I've now got grad students of my own that largely feel like peers to me, I think that's generally my approach anyways, but they feel like peers that I can sit down with and we can think, what do you think of this? And what do you think of this? That's really been fun. And when I think about being a professor, at least here, you've got your program of research, you've got your teaching load, a bunch of courses, and then you've got your service commitments, so different committees that you might sit on. And of those three, I really like research and I really like teaching, but I always liked service. I always liked sitting on committees and thinking, what are we doing together? What are we going to be able to accomplish? And I think it's because I like helping people and just helping generally. And so when I think about why I feel that this is a really fun role so far and why I feel so far like it's been a good fit, is I think because it most closely emulates that service element where largely, as I see it, I'm coming to work in this role now and I'm looking to help people. People will email with issues they're dealing with, program issues come up, and my job as I see it is to think, how can I help? How can I help think about a solution that might work? What can we do to support this student, this faculty member, this program? I think that's really the job that we're charged with. So looking at it that way, I'm not surprised that I'm enjoying it as much as I am. Even if it's challenging and it's a heavy, heavy learning curve, I really am enjoying the work because it is so focused at its core on helping people.
Yes, and it's those, it's interesting how the three kind of components of research, teaching, and service follow regardless. They shift depending on your role, but they remain at the core of being a faculty member.
And absolutely.
And I think with graduate programs, you can see a little bit of a mirror of that as well, although less defined. But I think a lot of graduate students, regardless of their level and postdocs as well, are focused on research. Some are focused on teaching a little bit, depending on if they have a teaching assistantship or a TFship. And then service, right? Whether that's supporting your colleagues in the lab or in the department informally, or, you know, organizing a graduate student conference or working at the national or international level of your discipline, like participating in association work and that kind of thing. So it's interesting to see as people transition from maybe graduate student to faculty member to administrative faculty member, how we see those same kind of containers continue that carry a lot of the different work that academics do.
Absolutely. And I'm still very much figuring out like how to fit the research in. I've got plans to do that, but being so new to a role, there's still a significant transition mm-hmm. period for me. So I'm carving out my time here and there, but I think I'm getting closer and closer to a sweet spot where I'm going to be able to continue to empower my grad students mm-hmm. to run various projects that we have going on, maintain relationships with community members that we're working with, and still be able to contribute, hopefully, to my research fields.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's I'm sure, like an ever-changing balance, right?
Sure.
The different seasons of your career, yeah. The different seasons of your life, they all
like
have to
that.
Shift.
Yeah, that's nice.
And like you mentioned, you are currently appointed as a faculty member in the Faculty of Education. And can you tell us a little bit about what your current research program is looking at?
Yeah. The last few years have been really interesting because it's been a lot of exploratory work with my students and I. We've been focused on trying to think about the individual education plan and how we can support our students with special education needs to better understand what's on that document, to put them in a position to advocate for their needs going forward. Mm. So the way we look at it, schools are getting better and better at meeting the needs of all learners. And this is a good thing, full stop. But we would say that as we get better and better at providing support for all in universal ways, that can obscure the real need for some students to get particular supports if we're not talking about it and talking to the students about how, hey, you need these things, we're putting them in place for you. So again, great if it's universally provided, that can help with stigma and all sorts of things. But at some point, we would argue that those students who have necessary supports, that needs to be explained to them to put them in a position to be able to advocate for themselves later on as they move through secondary school and eventually maybe into a post-secondary space or work. They're going to be the ones that need to own that information about themselves and to be able to talk to professors or employers to say, this is what I need and this is why I need it, those types of things.
Sounds very important because I know it seems like there's many changes going on in Ontario and in Canadian school systems across different provinces. So getting students to be able to advocate for themselves and understand what supports they need, I think that sounds very, very helpful for both students, parents, families, and the schools themselves. Are there some challenges that schools in Ontario or more broadly in Canada face in supporting students with exceptionalities or additional needs right now? Are there some challenges you see?
Probably the biggest issue that a lot of school boards and faculties of education together are wrestling with is how we support students with special education needs. Mm. Is it a full inclusion thing? Are we ready for that? So I think a lot of scholars that focus on inclusion would argue that this is something we should all be striving for. And in fact, probably everybody's pushing in that direction. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes there can be a bit of a chasm between where we think we should be and what we're actually able to do right now. And I think one of the issues is when we have knowledge about how things could work, how do we transfer that knowledge to teachers in the classroom that are dealing with very real issues all the time and doing their best to support students with and without special education needs? But when you're on the front lines, there are lots of issues. And it can be hard to put in place something that you're told to do in a professional development session. So I think a real issue is how do we give teachers the knowledge and skills and support that they need to make classroom spaces that are inclusive for all. And if we simply aren't at a place where we can do that, then what's the best alternative? Just keeping in mind that if we're working towards inclusion as much as we can, I think we also need to be honest with ourselves about what resources we have, what we can ask of teachers, what's realistic at this point to meet all learners' needs.
That tension between what could be and the excellent ideas and research that supports, you know, full inclusion, and then resources availability across different school boards and classrooms individually, and how to make those come together ideally. Now that makes a lot of sense. And I know many of our Queen's graduate students and our postdoc communities are parents themselves, often with younger children. What are some things you think parents can do to help their children excel academically in the current Ontario school system?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think about not just students with special education needs. I think any student, if you've got a child, if you're a parent or a guardian, you've got a child in our school system, I would say just talk to them about the challenges, obviously their passions and what's going well, but the challenges that they're experiencing. And so in the case where I've got three boys of my own and they experience different challenges, and I try to understand, what is it specifically that you're struggling with? Why do you think that might be the case? And then what do you think we can do about it? And I think those are just simple questions that hopefully probably a lot of parents and guardians are asking their kids already. But we always say, talk to your kids. If you're talking to them anyways, ask about those things. Mm-hmm. Try to understand the challenges that they're experiencing, because I think the more we normalize that kind of dialogue and inquiry, the more they're probably going to adopt it and eventually own it, right? And start to say, like, hey, I'm noticing I'm struggling, so what can I do about it? And they don't even necessarily need a guardian or a parent to provoke that kind of thinking.
So again, it sounds like it connects back to that advocacy piece of getting students to be able to advocate and understand themselves well. Oh, well, thank you. That's a very brief snapshot on research, but I want to focus a little bit more on your role as associate dean. So can you tell us a little bit more about it? I know you've just started, but what are some things in your portfolio?
Yeah, so I got a lovely document from Fahim and Chris and Tara that outlined, here's what the job is. Mm-hmm. And I think I keep going back to that and realizing, geez, they were so on point with that, because a lot of the different divisions within the role are very clear. And I think the amount of time I'm spending on those pieces are reflective of what they said, which is great. Mm-hmm. So as I understand it, a lot of our time is on what we call like student support, which could be things like, if you have a student reaching out, of course, right now, there are a lot of issues happening that are affecting our students with connections to Iran. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to remind students and faculty and staff to have students reach out to us if we can do anything to support them. Mm. So any kind of supports, it could be appeals, it could be extensions. That's one piece of it, is anything we can do to support students. And then I think another piece is looking at how we can support programs and faculty and staff. And so we do have license within our role for what we call special projects. And so something I'm really passionate about that I've talked to you a little bit about too is like career development and how we can put our students in the best position to secure employment after they graduate, not just to finish and have them start that process, but how can we really get them thinking about that and how can we support them in their time while they're here. So that's also a piece of it. And then, of course, there are lots of different committees that that Tara and I sit on. So grad councils, and then also specific committees that might have a specific nature about them. So it could be focused on trying to identify policy related to artificial intelligence. That's what I'm sitting on. And various other types of roles that we hold that way, where we're sort of representing the School of Grad Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs to try to make decisions for the university. And then just various administrative stuff. So we go through any theses or defenses, we go through the paperwork there. So that's, it could be considered less exciting stuff, but I think it's really cool because sometimes I recognize names and I'm reminded, oh yeah, this person just finished up. So yeah, it's a lot, Katie Marie, but it just feels very dynamic. It feels like every day I come in and I'm like, I have to remind myself of what I'm doing that day. But I really like that energy, and I like that, like, I got to be on and got to be ready for the next thing.
You know? There's always something fresh on the docket, right? You have your plans for the day, and then something else pops up, and that
exactly. You know that all too well, right? Yeah.
Your focus shifts, and then yes, return to the scheduled programming after. So you mentioned a little bit about some special projects and the committees and student and program support. I guess, what are you most excited about in this role? Because there's a lot of different moving parts. So what's something that is really exciting to you?
Yeah, I'm realizing that as I come up with ideas, I'm recognizing like people have already had these ideas and there's already a lot happening across the university in a lot of these areas. So I think my focus right now is trying to figure out who's doing what and where are they at in that process. But career development, like I said, is, I think it's one of the most important opportunities that we have, because of course, employment seems to be getting more and more challenging for our students to secure. And the labor market is changing all of the time. And so I really want to think about how I can lean into connecting better with our graduates to figure out where they're going, what types of skills and knowledge they're using in those settings, and how that might be able to inform what we do here to better prepare them for that journey. And then, of course, trying to identify while they're here, what types of supports, workshops, events, anything like that, that we could provide to better prepare them for that next step. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be great, again, to have students come to us and have a pretty clear sense of the types of things they could do with mm-hmm. their degree, and then what it would take to get there. And then I think the question becomes, how can we at the SGSPA help? What events can we run? What supports can we provide? Mm-hmm. What programming can we get you enrolled in that's going to make you a more competitive candidate and give you a better chance of securing that employment that you're looking for?
Mm-hmm. And there's so many options for graduates of different programs across campus, right? Which I think sometimes what can be overwhelming about the process is that in grad school, you develop all these different skills, whether they're qualitative or quantitative research, the kind of project management and determination, and some of those, the resilience, more of those soft skills that you develop alongside some more tangible skills, like maybe you become great at a programming language or something like that. So you've got this mix of skills, but how do you translate that outside of a research setting, outside of a university setting, to a potential employer? I know Career Services is doing excellent work, and I think that there's a lot of opportunity for us to work with the School of Graduate Studies, to work with Career Services and other campus supports to really hone in on what is unique about the grad experience and what is changing. Like you said, the job market is constantly evolving, and it seems like at a really rapid pace right now. So I think that's also very exciting, of how we can best support graduate students moving forward into their next roles after Queen's.
For sure.
And alongside this, I guess that's finding employment post-graduation is one challenge, but are there some other common challenges that you are noticing graduate students experiencing during their programs? And this can be, you know, as you're with your hat as associate dean or with your hat as a supervisor of graduate students, are there some common challenges you see?
Definitely funding. Like I think back to when you and I were grad students, and I think it was not that long ago, but a very different time. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, we're hearing from students about precarity with employment, not being able to necessarily fund like accommodations, use of food bank, things like this are like the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Right? Because they're about survival, ultimately. And so we have a lot of students increasingly that bring families as well. And so they're not just necessarily thinking about feeding and housing and supporting themselves. They're thinking about supporting a whole family. Mm-hmm. So that, I would say, would be like the priority is how do we ensure that we can give all of our students the kind of funding that they need to support themselves? Mm-hmm. And I think that's increasingly challenging when we have restraints on us as an institution, or, you know, across the country as institutions in higher education. So I wish I had a quick and easy answer. I know that my colleagues, including yourself, like are constantly working on and thinking about this. But I think that would be the most top of mind issue is how do we ensure that all of our students have what they need to engage in the work that we're bringing them here to do?
Mm-hmm. No, and I know it's... As you said, it's a challenge across Canada right now, the cost of living and just, I mean, if I think about my own grocery bill over the last few years, it has increased substantially. So, and I know the pace at which those day-to-day expenses are increasing, you know, everyone's salaries or funding packages aren't necessarily keeping pace with how fast those things are increasing. And I know it's not like institutions can control what grocery prices are, but how can we figure out ways to make sure that students and postdocs and staff and the whole Queen's community is doing okay? How can we think about what we can do?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think as an educator yourself, like it's, we always think about how if students aren't feeling like they have a full stomach, like they got enough sleep, all of those things, then they're probably not in a position to learn. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with our postdocs and graduate students, that if they're not feeling comfortable, if they're not feeling safe, all of those things, then they're probably not going to do the quality work that they could. You know, they're not going to meet their potential. And so I think about funding being related to like mental health and all of these other things that are connected. So I think, like you said, we have to get creative and work with the circumstances that we're in to try to ensure we can give students what they need, but then also think about the effects that funding can have on other parts of their life. So ensuring that we've got mental health and wellness supports in place and that students know about them and all of these other things that are surely connected.
Yes, it takes a holistic approach, right? Research takes a lot.
Great
so
way of
you need
it.
To have you need to be feeling well in many areas to do the best research that you can do.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I guess, what is some advice you would have for graduate students to make the most of their time at Queen's?
Yeah, I'm thinking about, like, what would I tell myself back as a graduate student? And I think you're just so busy mm-hmm. and your head is, like, down, necessarily so, because mm-hmm. there's so much that you need to focus on, from TA-ships potentially to research assistantships to your own program of research, like all the things that maybe are necessary mm-hmm. for you. It's hard. I don't necessarily feel comfortable saying, hey, do all the other yes. things, because everyone needs to figure out what works. But I do think it's, like, fundamentally important to at least take some time to figure out what are the types of things that I could do in my first year, that I could do in my second mm-hmm. year, that I wouldn't necessarily find out about because they're not compulsory. They're not necessary parts of my program. So the PhD community initiative is just one idea that comes to mind. But I had one of my graduate students participate in that, and she said it was incredibly valuable for her, made new relationships and built some new skills for her as well. And so I just think about, I didn't even recommend that to her. She found it on her own. Mm-hmm. So how can I do a better job as a supervisor to be aware of the types of programs we have? And that's not always easy because, of course, supervisors and faculty are busy. So as a student, I would just encourage them to check out, take some time, mm-hmm. maybe once every few weeks, just do a quick scan and see what's going on, what events are available, what programs might I think about. And then I think at those pivotal points, like moving into your second year or moving into your third year, if you're in a longer program, what's my long-term plan this year? What are the things I must do? And then what are some things I could consider? And again, connecting it back to career development, what types of things might help me get to that or move on that pathway towards my ultimate goal of this type of job or that type of job following graduation?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think PhDCI is an excellent example of an extracurricular program that can kind of offer many opportunities to students in terms of networking, in terms of developing different skills, working in teams, getting to learn about a new industry or area depending on who the community partner is, like if that's more health-based or more arts-based or whatever, you know, whatever the organization that you're partnered with may be, that gives you insight into a whole new world that you maybe didn't know really existed or know about the jobs that happen in that world until you participate. And you get to meet a bunch of other PhD students, which is always nice too, to meet people outside of your program.
Definitely.
Yeah. No, that's one that I did not participate in as a graduate student, and I kind of wish I did.
We should have.
That's like one of the few programs I didn't try, and it sounds like a great time, so I wish I had them.
Me too.
Yeah, and I think there's some other great programs. Like, I know we have 3-minute thesis coming up, which is a really great way to practice communication skills and some knowledge mobilization, how to translate your research to a non-specialist audience in 3 minutes or less. I think that's a great skill to to develop.
Or GradFlix being another one, right? Mm-hmm, so just trying to identify ways that we can help students mobilize the knowledge they're creating, all of this stuff. And again, like you said, there are a lot of options. It's not like everyone can do everything, mm-hmm. but I think being aware of what is possible and then thinking about your ultimate goal or goals of employment and connecting those and thinking which of these types of programs might be worth my time and might really help prepare me for my next step. I think mm-hmm. that's important. And that's probably the single piece of advice I would say is most important.
Mm-hmm. So yes, having that long-term vision and almost, it sounds like, doing a little bit of self-assessment of, like, what do I know really well? What do I want to learn more about?
Yeah.
And how can I find a place to learn more about whatever skill I feel like I don't have or want to develop further? And I think Queen's is great for having many opportunities of all kinds, whether that's in your program, whether that's something the SGSPA offers, whether that's something another central service offers, be that like career services or student wellness. Like there's so many different opportunities to get involved and to learn all these things across campus. And I think, yes, it can be a little overwhelming, but if you check in.
That's how I would describe my first couple of months in this program, is because, like you said, I'm learning about all these things that are already happening. And I think that's been a heavy part of my transition is mm-hmm. what's already happening here? What do I need to know about? So, yeah, I've really, really enjoyed the journey so far, and mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to what's to come.
Yes, and I think, yes, for students as well to take that time and think and look across what is already happening and what they can tap into. And then if they find something that's missing, I think the great thing about Queen's is you can start a student club, you can start a group, you can create your
great
own
point.
Thing, right? If you're looking for something and it doesn't exist, you can also start it yourself. Mm-hmm. Well, Ian, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been great chatting with you. And I look forward to continue working with you on a daily basis in the SGSPA, and then maybe we can have you on again as throughout your term as projects develop, or if there's any updates you want to share with the Grad Chat community.
That sounds great, KM. Thanks for the opportunity. This was fun.
So that is it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic, every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
He who controls the spice controls the universe!
When the clock strikes midnight, the night truly begins. Step into the darkness on CFRC's Retro Radio Show, diving deep into the sounds of the past.